Hey there, you're listening to Virago Pod, a podcast that is dedicated to empowering and improving the physical and mental health of female athletes everywhere.
This podcast is brought to you by The Virago Project, a nonprofit organization that helps female athletes balance sports with life.
I'm your host, Emily McGee Zaslowski.
And I'm your co-host, Taylor Tracy. Let's jump right into the episode.
Hi, Virago Warriors, and welcome back to episode 9. I am so excited for you to hear this topical issue today on Title IX and name, image, and likeness, because on the currency of this current topic, right now, there is an athlete's bill of rights being introduced in Congress by Cory Booker, and it will really change so many things, including guaranteeing players monetary compensation, a plan for long-term health care, some revenue sharing possibilities. So this is a huge, huge thing that will be happening this month, next month, that we will be keeping an eye on. So to give some background, Taylor brought on Instagram account, Friends of the Court, Mercedes, and she does most of the talking since Taylor and Mercedes have more of a relationship since they're the kind of people behind the two Virago Project and Friends of the Court Instagram. So I will leave them to introduce it more, but we will be keeping you updated with this legislation and any updates of what happens with this. All right, let's get into today's episode.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Virago Pod. I am with Mercedes Townsend today, and she is going to give us the lowdown on everything Title IX and name, image, likeness in the NCAA. How are you doing, Mercedes? Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk about this with y'all.
Awesome. Okay, so I first found Mercedes through Instagram. Very, very cliche, I know, but we live in the world of social media now. And she has this amazing account called Friend of the Court, or FOTC. So Mercedes, can you tell us a little bit about what Friend of the Court is and how it's relevant to our conversation today?
Yeah, of course. And thank you for that compliment. Friend of the Court is a Instagram website platform that's dedicated to developments in women's sports law. I am a full-time attorney, went to school for sports law, and am on the board for some sports organizations that are local to New Orleans, and started Friend of the Court as a way to not only get information out about updates in women's sports, but particularly women's sports law.
Yeah. And, you know, I love it for all of those reasons, too. Not only do I feel like men's sports law cases are just most in your face and women's sports aren't, except with the exception of course, the U.S. women's national team. That's all over the place. But, you know, I feel like when we think about sports agents and, you know, sport law practices, not a lot of women are even represented, like women attorneys, or talked about. So I think it's really cool that you are a woman and that you're studying, or that you studied sport law and now you're practicing, and that you're also providing an avenue, not just for, you know, normal people, non-attorneys like me and Emily to learn, you know, to learn about these cases that are impacting women in sport today, but also to provide an avenue for aspiring young women attorneys who want to work with athletes and work in sports. So really, really love that.
I certainly appreciate it. I have been doing Friend of the Court since September. And one of the things that I've realized, apart from educating non-attorneys, getting in conversations with particularly women in sports, but all sorts of sports professional, Friend of the Court has also served in a kind of know your rights capacity. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for this conversation, especially about Title IX and name, image, and likeness, because Title IX suits can only be brought by students. Mm-hmm. And so if students are empowered and know their rights about it, or know the general framework of it, it's easier for them to spot these issues in their own institutions.
Mm. Yes, and we're going to jump right into Title IX because I feel like, you know, this is such a huge kind of legal word that's just tossed around left and right. But, and we know that it has something to do with creating equity for women, and it plays a role in creating equity for women athletes, especially at NCAA institutions. But maybe we don't know the details of it. So can you tell us, Mercedes, just generally, what is Title IX and how does it impact women athletes, more specifically college women athletes?
Sure. Title IX is an amendment to the Civil Rights Act on Education. It's an educational amendment. And it was passed in 1972, authored by Congresswoman Patsy Mink, who, just fun fact, was the first woman of color, the first Asian American woman elected to Congress.
Holla!
So Title IX is, like I said, it's a 1972 education amendment to the Civil Rights Act, and it, I'm paraphrasing here, says that no educational institution that receives federal money can discriminate on the basis of gender. It has to provide equal opportunity. But Title IX also serves in a capacity, you see it almost more so now, in addressing gender-based violence on campus, mm-hmm. and sexual violence on campus. Transgender student rights on campus, which there's intersection there with sports and having transgender athletes being able to participate in the sport that affirms their gender. But broadly, painting with broad strokes here, Title IX, like I said, is the muscle behind women's collegiate athletics. It creates a mechanism for student athletes to enforce or maintain athletic opportunities for them.
Okay, so question. But if I'm an NCAA athletic, athletic director, mm-hmm. and I want to adhere to Title IX, does that mean that I need to have the same amount of women's sports team as men's sports team, or do I need to just provide equal opportunity for the same number of women athletes as I would men athletes?
So that's a great question. The three prongs for athletic-related compliance under Title IX, mm-hmm. is either that a school has to provide proportional opportunities for women athletes that is representative of the amount of women students on campus.
Mm.
So in other words, say your student population is made up of 60% of students who identify as female, identify as women, 60% of your athletic opportunities need to be for women.
Okay.
And the trend is that majority of colleges and universities are made up of majority women students.
Wow.
That's one prong. So it doesn't have to be equal 50-50. It has to be proportional to the makeup of the student population. Yeah. And so given the trend of more women being enrolled in colleges, it would actually be closer to 55-45 for women.
Okay.
The second prong, so if your school isn't able to meet that, the second prong would be that the school has a history of creating opportunities for the historically marginalized gender. So for the most part, that's women, mm-hmm. but some colleges that were former all women's colleges, the historically underrepresented gender would be men.
Mm-hmm.
The third prong, so if you aren't able to meet either of those two, the third is that the athletic opportunities that you do offer match the interests and wants of your student population. So basically saying, we sent out a survey, everybody's satisfied with what we're offering. And that's the shakiest prong.
Yes.
Because as you can, I'm sure, imagine how many people are completing the survey, who's formulating the survey, what percentage student population needs to respond in order for you to say this was a successful survey.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the three prongs. If you're an athletic director, if you're a Title IX coordinator in an athletic department, those are the three prongs. You're trying to hit one of them to make sure you're in compliance.
Wow.
Yeah. Taylor, I remember at UNC, well, because there's always more female than male, but that was part of the reason, because I looked into this a little bit, but since we have a football team, that's why I remember when I was there, I was surprised to find out the women's swimming team had more scholarships than the male swimming team. The women's softball team had more scholarships than the baseball team. It does a lot to have equality, especially in the schools that have like a specifically male-dominated sport, like, and, you know, large scholarship number sport like football.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I wonder though, like, okay, so you have these three prongs. What's stopping a school, for example, for like, if they are spending most of their budget or want to spend most of their budget on like the revenue generating sports like football and basketball, and they do this survey, right, with the third prong, and you know, they just collect biased feedback from the students on what their interests are, and it leans more heavily towards the football and the basketball team. Like, I'm just astounded that that could be something that would, you know, influence how many scholarships or how many playing opportunities are provided for women athletes as well. Mercedes, do you have any thoughts on that, or do you know of any cases where an athletic department relied heavily on that third prong?
So just maybe to astound you even more, and probably isn't surprising at all, a lot of institutions are not in compliance with Title IX when it comes to athletics. They either don't have a history of continuing to add programs for the historically underrepresented gender. We'll just say women. They aren't meeting the proportionality factor. And off top, I can't name you a case where the third factor was relied upon. And here's why. Title IX lawsuits or Title IX complaints, as I alluded to in the beginning, are levied by student athletes. Part of it is it can't be, so Taylor, I know you're an alumnus of UNC. You can't say, as an alumnus, I see this happening. I'm filing a Title IX lawsuit. It has to be filed by students who would have, quote, standing. They're the ones who are being deprived of this opportunity. When a Title IX complaint or a Title IX lawsuit, if it gets to a lawsuit, is filed, it's usually because a team has been cut. So if you are cutting a team, the second prong of we have a history of expanding the program, you don't. You just cut a team. So you could have added a program every single year for the last 10 years, but you just cut a team. So you don't have that history. And then the second prong of we're meeting the interests of our students, no, you don't. You're not meeting the interest of the already formed women's track team you just cut. So that kind of balances out, hopefully, your concerns.
Okay, yeah, it does. So it does seem like there's a bit of a checks and balance going on. So my next question then is, who enforces Title IX legislation on these college campuses? And how do they measure whether or not an institution is in compliance with Title IX?
So the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights is the enforcement agency for Title IX, and they gauge by those three prongs we've talked about. The issue with that is because it is a department that is dependent and billed out by whoever the current executive officer, whoever the current president is, it tends to flip-flop with each administration.
Okay. So there's not like schools don't have a person who like all of the Title IX reports go to. It's more of like an appointed position by the government. Is that what you mean?
Well, the government is the enforcement agency. Some schools, some institutions do have a designated Title IX officer who might be the Title IX person for all iterations of Title IX. So Title IX sports, gender-based violence, That person might oversee all Title IX compliance. Some athletic departments have a Title IX officer, but it isn't something that every school has.
Okay.
I know you have a lot of, I know there are a lot of women athletes that follow y'all and are part of this group. And I just want to, throughout all of my time with y'all, impress upon like the power athletes have. The court of public opinion is still very alive and well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what I want to encourage everyone is some of these changes, some changes like we've seen over the summer, come not from a legal argument, but more so a policy argument. Like it's good policy and good practice for us to have this.
Yeah, thank you. And I would definitely agree with what you just said. Like students have a voice and they definitely should speak up if they see any, you know, gross inequities or just inequities at all between women and men athletes in their school. I wonder, Mercedes, how would an athlete go about reporting, you know, a Title IX violation at their school? Would they go to that office, like the Title IX office? Would they go to like a student athlete development administrator? What would you do if you were a student athlete on campus and you noticed that your university, you know, was violating or not complying with this legislation?
The way that you would discover that violation, it would depend, right? So if I'm a student who notices that, man, we only have three women's teams, but 65% of our student population is made up of women.
Mm-hmm.
We are the majority of the population here on campus, and we only have three teams. You could, of course, go to your athletic administration. And part of what's been done in case law, specifically around Title IX, is universities showing that they've created these committees that include student athletes to build out which would be how to best bring new teams, new opportunities for women on campus. Mm-hmm. So that is a route. What we see most, especially kind of the big stories in the news, is a team has been cut.
Mm-hmm.
And so what some student athletes do once, especially if it's their team that's been cut, they will first try to petition to the institution, right?
Mm-hmm.
President, athletic director, and try to get meetings with them, explain, and if they're unsuccessful, usually that's when they lawyer up.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's happening a lot today. You know, I was watching 60 Minutes on, I think it comes on Sunday night. We watch it every week, Sunday night. And one of the journalists there actually did a really interesting interview on the Minnesota program cuts that happened in response to COVID-19. So they cut their men's gymnastics team and a few others. And it was mostly men's teams that they cut, or at least that they highlighted. And, you know, now that we're having this conversation, I can kind of reflect on that and be like, okay, there's probably a reason why they chose to let go of the men's teams and not the women's teams. Probably had to do with Title IX when they're coming down to making their final decisions about what teams to cut. But I do know that a lot of other women's teams have been cut this year. So I did want to just, you know, acknowledge that for a second. And, you know, just send my heart out to those women and those athletes and even those men at Minnesota Gymnastics, because it's never easy. But yeah, I would definitely say like take Mercedes' advice if you do see that, you know, a program cut or just there's this vast, you know, gap in, you know, how many women's programs are being offered versus how many men's programs. Go to your student athlete advisory council head, talk to them, go to the administration office or the athletic administration office. And like she said, like, you know, you have a voice and you should definitely use it. So thank you for that insight, Mercedes.
Yeah, of course. And just to go off of what the point you just raised, Taylor, because I think it's an important one and it gets used both ways. And it's the cutting men's teams In order to stay in compliance with Title IX. And Title IX has become villainous for a lot of people because you see men's teams getting cut. And the issue there is that Title IX does not require that schools cut men's teams in order to stay in compliance.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is schools will cut men's teams because of budget crisis, but you don't see systemically other changes, like the AD takes a pay cut. We're going to arrange funding, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens whether it's a men's team or a women's team get cut.
Yeah, I think you bring up great points just on like the transparency. And I only knew the scholarship breakdown because of an exercise in sports science, like sports administration, like example I did, where it was like that same thing, like, hey, what program are you going to cut? Type thing. And ultimately, the answer was basically like, are there any other ways you can move the budget without cutting the teams? But I think any student athlete listening, even if they're like, no, I don't think we're in violation, I think we're fine, it's a great conversation to be having right now when things like aren't in crisis mode, just to be familiar and to know the procedures and know how that those budgets are made. So that's something that I didn't even know was an option to like find information about, and all this stuff is just making me like so curious what universities across the country are. So don't be afraid to ask the questions. Like you said, go to the administration. This is something that they probably have data on. That just like blew my mind, Mercedes.
And to kind of build on that, the data is actually online. Taylor, I'll do the link and y'all can share it. There's a tool online that you can put in your institution and see the breakdown and see what amount of money goes to women's sports, what amount of money goes to men's advertising, what the student population is, how that compares to what the ratio for athletic opportunities is.
Yeah.
So I'll find that link so you can share it out. Just before we do move on, and to build on that, and it's not specific to Title IX, but it just goes into how we view college sports. Check out the efforts of Clemson University's track team, track and cross country team, because they are slated to be cut by the university. And they have mobilized this effort to say, we are this institution's, this is where the majority of your Black athletes participate in a non-revenue generating sport.
Right.
So this, and it goes to show who is on the, for lack of a better word, chopping block. And it's always going to be those teams that aren't generating revenue. But then when we look at what the NCAA, the NAIA, even some courts who hear these cases on paying college athletes, what they say the purpose of college sports are, character development, personal development. And so both can't be true.
Right. And, I think that just is perfect segue right there into the name, image, likeness theme, the second focus of this podcast, because there is a financial component to this issue. And maybe you've heard about it, maybe you've not. The NIL cases, I think the most prominent one that happened was the Edward O'Bannon case. But Mercedes, let's just really quickly, let's talk about name, image, likeness. Can you just explain what's going on in that realm with the NCAA, what the rules are, and how this is, impacting athletes today?
Sure. So NIL, name, image, and likeness, is essentially, and it's legally referred to as your right of publicity, that you have the right to benefit financially from the use of your name, your image, or your likeness. And likeness meaning a cartoon version of you or your voice that alludes to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so name, image, and likeness, those are laws, or right of publicity, those are laws that are instituted at the state level. And that everyone has, that no one can financially profit from the unauthorized use of your name, image, and likeness. Taylor Swift is a very frequent litigant on this issue. So if you for example, used a billboard promoting your shoe store and had a Taylor Swift picture, it suggests to the person seeing the billboard that Taylor Swift endorses your shoes, and you didn't pay her for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, in a nutshell, is what name, image, and likeness right of publicity is.
Okay.
Perfect. Mercedes, I'm not sure. Is there, like, common, I honestly, I don't know much about it. Are there common NIL violations that happen a lot in student athletes specifically that are like, this is the big one that right now athletes are really missing out on? So, like, I know you mentioned the FIFA. That one comes to mind for, I've seen that in the
YouTube.
News that they're using collegiate
YouTube
athletes.
Is huge.
YouTube.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of the big ones are that, like you said, Taylor, student athletes can't benefit. They cannot monetize their YouTube channels, should they have one, even if they are just kind of like day in the life vlogs. They cannot monetize off of that.
Mm-hmm.
Some other examples, these are things that athletes get flagged or in trouble for, would be autographs, mm-hmm. right? Charging for autographs.
Oh, yeah.
That's one that they're flagged for. One that that athletes often bring to say this is violating my name, image, and likeness rights is the school's use of their picture or footage to promote things after they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And so say a football camp and you use my highlight reel or you use pictures of me in the flyer promoting the football camp.
Mm-hmm.
You've also seen it to where institutions will refer to a former student athlete in their new professional capacity, right? So if LSU were to say, LSU of the Cincinnati Bengals, or Joe Burrow of the Cincinnati Bengals,
mm-hmm.
That would be an example. One of the bigger ones is definitely use of picture and images post-graduation, but also currently is these broadcasting opportunities that especially around college football playoffs, March Madness, and the broadcasting dollars that institutions in the NCAA bring in, and athletes see none of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, Emily and I can definitely, and of course, Mercedes, you're well-versed in this, but as athletes, former Division I athletes, I think we can both really, really talk about this. I know some of the NIL issues that came up for me as an athlete even came down to like the jobs and internships that I was allowed mm-hmm. to have. So for example, you know, when I got to college, if I wanted to go to a little sports shop down the road in college and get a job, that employer could not hire me on the fact that I was Taylor Tracy, the volleyball player at UNC. Whereas maybe, you know, someone who's involved with a student council at a college may say like, oh, I want to get an internship or a job at the local courthouse. And an employer might look at that and be like, oh, well, like they're involved in student council. Of course, we're going to hire them. And that's just easy as pie, not for athletes. So that's just one example of how this name, image, likeness thing is really, you know, holding student athletes back in, you know, careers, just for example.
Yeah. And so I think that's a very important point to make because we very often get caught up in the Heisman Trophy winner can't get paid for a Nike commercial, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you think of kind of commerce and getting paid for your name, image, and likeness in that way, in kind of a traditional endorsement way. But the rules also narrow in on other opportunities, like you were talking about, Taylor, like your job. For a very long time, the bylaw that limits your ability to get paid for your name, image, and likeness
mm-hmm.
has really kind of exploited athletes.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because I'm sure y'all remember, you sign over your name, image, and likeness rights to the university in order for you to participate in sport.
Signing day. And sign over your life.
So, while the institution can enter into broadcasting deals for however much money, or can get sponsorships from Coca-Cola or whatever it wants, and your picture is used in the reel, right? You've signed that over. What Ed O'Bannon and other student athletes and former student athletes have gone to court for this and sued over is that you, the school, continues to benefit from my name, image, and likeness while I'm no longer a student athlete.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And because I've waived those rights, and it happened because it was in the NCAA game from EA, the video game, right?
Yeah.
And so they're like, y'all are still using my character in this video game, and I'm 10 years removed from being a student athlete, and I can't get paid.
Right.
The NCAA is proposing rule changes so that student athletes can benefit from their name, image, and likeness, that they can participate in commercials and ads and kind of those traditional mechanisms that we think of when we think of benefiting from your image. But some of the proposed rules as it stands now is that your institution, your college or university, can deny a particular opportunity if it believes that it interferes with its own sponsorship agreements.
Oh my gosh.
So say you get an opportunity for Pepsi and you go to a Coke school, right?
Yeah, UNC That's with Nike.
Right. It can also, you can refer to yourself as an athlete, but you cannot use your school logo. There's case law that school colors invoke a school logo. And so you may also be limited that you couldn't use. So I went to LSU that you couldn't wear purple and gold in a commercial.
Wow.
And so those are some of, while a lot of folks are celebrating it, to say NCAA is moving forward and we're going to allow college athletes to get paid. There is still much work to be done because there is still a very heavy burden for athletes to meet to be able to get approved for whatever opportunities they get.
Yeah. And when you think about like, okay, so you might be hearing what Mercedes said, our listeners I'm talking to, and you think, okay, well, the athlete will still be able to go on television for Pepsi or whatever, you know, just as an athlete without maybe the LSU colors. Like when you go to a school and you become an athlete at that school and you're a standout athlete at that school, like those colors are a part of your personal brand now. Like, you know, Michael Jordan, everyone knows he's a Tar Heel. So I don't think that, you know, back in the 1980s or whenever he played at UNC, if he showed up on a Pepsi commercial after his freshman year without UNC blue or anything on it, like, would anybody really, like, who's to say, you know, people would recognize him without the jersey or like without the Bulls jersey. So it's just, I don't know. It does seem to be limiting in that sense. But on the other hand, when you do sign up to go to a school, you are kind of entering a partnership with them. And so maybe the athletes and the universities need to work together and, you know, kind of give and take, because I'm sure the universities are losing a lot of money. Well, they will lose a lot of money whenever brands can go directly to the athletes.
And, you know, that's still to be determined in a lot of ways, right? And the school could be set to lose money, but it could gain partnerships in other ways. If it goes directly to the athlete, to say, I don't know, Apple goes directly to the athlete and wants them in a Mac commercial, that could also open up opportunities as part of the partnership for the school to get an opportunity as well. And the thing we have to kind of consistently remind ourselves of is that the NCAA's stated purpose and all of these member institutions' stated purpose for collegiate athletics is not to make money. We know that's not the case, right? We know that's not the case.
Oh, they're making a ton.
Right. But like when you look at a mission statement, it's to provide educational opportunities through the advancement of sport. And that's kind of pretty close to what the NCAA's mission statement is, right? And so how does that align with your mission statement? One thing that I don't know if a lot of people are aware of that I'd like to bring because I'm talking to y'all is kind of the recent villainization of college cheerleaders because they are able to benefit from their name, image, and likeness. And everyone, yes. But the stipulation to that is that they're not NCAA sanctioned teams. So all of the opportunities that cheerleaders lose from not being an NCAA sanctioned team, right? So the benefit is, sure, I can endorse things on my Instagram. I get to be a quote unquote influencer, but I don't get a scholarship. I don't get to compete. And I think it's that balancing act as well. And also to kind of talk about why we go after women athletes, cheerleaders are athletes, why we go after women athletes who are able to benefit from the system that left them out.
Yeah, I think that I just would I don't understand why they would be vilified if, you know, they're not even allowed to accept scholarships for all of the work that they're doing. That just it seems I don't know, just like a fruitless argument to me. You know, give these athletes a chance to make a name for themselves if they can. There's no need to take that away from them. I'm wondering, Mercedes, and this is my last question about name, image, and likeness. If it is passed, these new regulations later this year, do you think that we'll see a wider gap between, you know, the Power Five schools and also the revenue generating sports at those schools because of the opportunities that they'll be given for endorsements and sponsorships? So I'm talking about like, you know, I'm talking about like a Big Ten school like Wisconsin versus a small D3 school. And I can see the same for women athletes. You know, I bet you $1 million, Trevor Lawrence this year, if name and image and likeness had allowed him to receive sponsorships and stuff, this guy would be a millionaire already. And you know, he's going to be next year in a few months. So, but what about, you know, the female athlete counterpart at the school? What kind of opportunities are they going to get? And is it just going to make these gender disparities even more obvious and apparent?
So there's definitely a concern, right, that the rich are going to get richer, that LSU and the Wisconsins and the UNCs and the big brand named college teams are going to get an unfair recruiting advantage. But when we're talking about, I mean, they already have one, right? I mean, they already benefit from that. They already benefit from having hyper funded athletic departments. And so I think the trend that we see already is going to remain. It might shift a little bit. If the NCAA does pass this legislation, in whatever version of it, all student athletes would be able to benefit from it. So even if you are at a small school, you could get a deal with a regional or a local company or organization. It also gives room for if your school makes a run and there's an upset in March Madness, there's an opportunity to really capitalize that you wouldn't have had before. And so I don't know that allowing for name, image, and likeness will create an unfair advantage for big name schools, but there already is one. And to women athletes, it's a little more complicated because these endorsement, we'll call them endorsement opportunities. These endorsement deals will be from third parties, right? They'll be from companies, they'll be from Coke, they'll be from FitFab Fun, they'll, right? Just companies that aren't bound by Title IX because they're not educational programs. I think the upside, though, with having, I think women athletes stand to gain a lot. And here's why. A lot of women's teams, there is no professional equivalent, right? So an issue that we have seen for a lot of college athletes, I don't want to say all, but for a lot, and especially the ones who are bringing this case, are the likelihood of me getting to play at the professional level are very slim. And so the college version of my name, image, and likeness, me as an All-American, me as a SEC champion, that's what I can benefit from. Because if I don't make it to the league, I don't get to benefit from my professional name, image, and likeness.
Right.
That argument is heightened when it's a woman playing on a team that there is no professional level. And Caitlin Ohashi made this, the UCLA gymnast. She's like, there is no professional gymnastics league. So the videos that go viral of me doing my floor routines in college, that's my opportunity to benefit.
Right. And she hasn't been able to, per se, on those videos that, have the UCLA jersey on her because of these laws, right?
Well, so the laws aren't the, and by laws, bylaws. And I think that's something important for people to remember too, is like, these are NCAA bylaws. They're not actual laws that the police can arrest you for, right? Or you can get sued for. Should the versions of the proposed rules pass to where you can't have your school logo, then no, she wouldn't be able to benefit from that routine and that viral video. I'd be interested to see what in what arguments a school would make. So say she gets in just a plain colored leotard and does the exact same floor routine while Nike's in the background. I'm interested to see if the school has an argument to say, well, this floor routine became famous for our school.
And I'm sure they would say something. The routine was conceptualized in the UCLA gymnasium or, whatever angle. So there's so much to unpack about the name, image, likeness policies and how that's affecting college athletes today in school. I will say I do wish that more athletes had opportunities to make money on their own, because I know it's not easy for these athletes to get jobs. Like, you're being a college athlete, it's a full-time job. And sure, you're getting scholarship money if you're lucky. But that doesn't usually typically cover your meals. That doesn't typically cover any outside expenses that you have. And so, especially the athletes who are coming from economically disadvantaged households, like, having a college scholarship, that's not really a lot. I mean, it's a good gift, but when you're working 40 hours a week and then 60 hours a week when you travel, on the weekends as a college athlete, like, are you really, really reaping the benefits of that full scholarship and like getting that education? And is it worth it to not be able to have a job? I don't know. So those are questions that we need to ask ourselves, I think, when it comes to thinking about name, image, and likeness and giving these athletes extra opportunities, to be paid.
Absolutely. And I think it, like you said, there's a lot to unpack, and it's certainly a systemic issue. And so just because one facet of it may have been solved and that there's going to be relaxed name, image, and likeness bylaws for the NCAA does not mean that it's resolved completely at all. And so one thing that I would just always impart upon your listeners is A, to kind of recognize their own voice, their own ability to create change, but B, to always interrogate, who's being left out here? How does this system affect, like you said, people from disadvantaged or underserved communities, people of color, Black people, particularly Black women athletes, to constantly interrogate that.
Well, thank you, Mercedes, for breaking down Title IX and NIL for us. This is something that is just super interesting, and I know there's a lot going around there. And honestly, we just kind of scratched the surface. It just goes so deep. But we really, really appreciate you coming on and sharing, your wisdom. This was really helpful, and hopefully, the athletes who had questions about some of these topics were able to pull something from this, and are better equipped to, speak up if they do see any violations going on at their school. So thank you, Mercedes.
Thank you so much for having me.
See you guys next time.